welcome to the fourth episode of Pop the Left. This month, both C. Derek Varn and Nicholas Pell are missing, and instead, there is a special guest. John Zerzan is an American anarchist and primitivist philosopher and author. He is fairly well known, especially in the Pacific Northwest, where I am, and his books about green anarchism have been influential. But we don't really talk about the environment, agriculture, or civilization, but rather I try to explain what I think is Zerzan's conceptual or philosophical mistake. For Zerzan, civilized life is a mediated or alienated life that isn't worth living, and his solution is to return to directly lived experience instead. What I try to point out in my conversation with him is that this solution is a part of the problem. That is, while he wants to overcome the problem of reification, his solution doesn't manage to avoid that mistake. The word reification means to mistake an abstraction for a physical or empirical object. A reification is not when we see an example of an abstraction in the world. It's not when we take a rubber ball and think of it as an example of roundness, but rather when we take an abstraction to be its own example. That is, when we think that an abstraction like roundness can exist on its own without an example. And there are many ideas that are founded on this mistake. God, for instance, is the kind of idea that is a good example of a reification. And nature is similarly the same kind of idea. Again, my conversation with John Zerzan wasn't about prehistory or hunters and gatherers. It wasn't about the current ecological problems that are facing us, but was aimed at his concepts. It was aimed at his idea that we might be able to escape concepts, which I think is his fundamental mistake. John Zerzan is an American anarchist and primitivist philosopher and author. His works criticize agricultural civilization as inherently oppressive. He is the author of many books, including Twilight of the Machines and Running on Emptiness, which is a book we're going to look at today, or talk about. Zerzan is an influential thinker, especially in the Pacific Northwest, and while not everyone wants to follow his argument all the way to the end, his perspective on nature and the need to return to a simpler way of life has been influential and pervasive now, really. His ideas certainly influenced my thinking as I came to anarchism in the 90s, and I'm glad, if a bit intimidated, to speak to him today for a special Diet Soap Pop the Left podcast. So, John, thank you very much for...
Thank you, Doug.
What I do, the Diet Soap podcast, is mostly a philosophy podcast, and so I'm not any kind of expert on... anthropology or prehistory or history. What I'm most interested in talking to you about today is the ideas in your essays, especially in the Running on Emptiness book. You mentioned Immanuel Kant, and you wrote that Kant decided that the key to philosophy lies in the answer to the question, what is the ground of the relation of that in us, which we call representation to the object? And you went on and said, unfortunately, he divined for modern thought an ahistorical and fundamentally inadequate answer, namely that we are simply not constituted so as to be able to understand reality directly. I just wanted to kind of explain what I thought Kant meant, or why Kant would say that we are constituted as to be unable to understand reality directly. And I think it was the problem of perception that he was dealing with. You have an experience, but the experience isn't directly of an object, but it is seemed to be held in your consciousness as a representation. And this was the problem that Kant and many other philosophers are trying to overcome or come up with a solution for, is how do we know the world if we're always dealing in our own mind rather than directly with the world.
Right, exactly. I think that's right.
Hegel came after Kant, and he tried to solve it as well. He started his solution for it in the phenomenology of spirit with sense certainty as the first step towards understanding the problem. And sense certainty is something that breaks down. So we actually begin with what I consider to be kind of a depiction of what you would like us to return to, which is this kind of immediate experience that we take to be real. But then after that, we run into the problem of perception in Hegel's book. And I think historically we ran into that problem as well. And it was only for Hegel, it was only by going through that, that we could come to knowledge, that we that sense certainty was a mistake. So I just wanted to know what your solution for the problem of perception was and how you...
Well, I think you have to start with the fact of alienation. I mean, they're not, that's not a problem for them. I mean, in other words, these things take place in a certain vacuum. In fact, that's why I'm not very comfortable with being called a philosopher, because I think thinking at its most general doesn't get you anywhere. I mean, it could mean almost anything, and we see the case of Heidegger or Sartre falling for the most unbelievably repressive things, and you might say there's nothing wrong with their philosophy, but except it leaves out quite a lot of the grounding that, you know, that, I mean, these problems, or you could say, you could extend your list a little bit to include phenomenology, you know, Husserl and so forth, wanted to get to outside of the concepts to the experience itself, you know, the preconceptual, maybe we could get underneath, so to speak, to the objects themselves. You know, that was one of the watchwords of, I mean, I think it failed, but I think these things, if they leave out social existence, well, then you don't really get anywhere. I mean, it's the anthropology. You simply have to have it, or you end up with positions that, are only true insofar as they're true in an alienated world, in a world of estrangement. I give you one example. I mean, Horkheimer and Adorno, Dialectic of Enlightenment, it's a wonderful take on the repressive aspect of civilization, or you could say domestication, and how deep-seated that is. And it's really a great critique of civilization. You have to give up... You have to give up play and instinctual freedom and eros and all that. Otherwise, you don't get civilization. I mean, as Freud pointed out as well. But then at the end, I hope this is relevant, Doug. Anyway, at the end of Dialectic of Enlightenment, as you may recall, they say, well, but then after all, if you don't dominate nature, you won't have society. Society absolutely depends on the domination of nature. Well, now we have a lot of evidence that that's not so. That people lived in harmony with nature. They didn't need to dominate nature. They didn't need to domesticate, in other words. So you could say, conceivably, you could say, if we could go back in time to Adorno and Horkheim and just ask that question, well, what if that's not true? Then everything you said has a very radical implication. In other words, we don't have to do that. We don't have to have civilization. We don't need that repression. I mean, people lived just fine.
You're moving away from the realm of philosophy, and I respect why you're saying that.
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from. I'm not very interested in the abstractions of Kant or these others. I mean, because you can see almost at a glance what they're not. I was trying to bring it up to, you know, with Horkheimer and Adorno, a practical illustration of you can have an abstract critique, but what is it based on? Is it based on reality as a starting point or not?
Right. Well, I mean, that's Marx's critique of philosophers as well.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that in his thesis on Feuerbach, he says essentially that the philosopher acts as though they exist in a bubble outside of the society they're in.
I agree with him there.
Yeah.
Not with a lot of other stuff.
Right.
But that's, I think it's very sound.
Right. So, but the thing that you do and what you've just done is you've said that you want to step away from abstraction, but then you did actually present an argument that was kind of an abstract argument to back up your position. And you refer to a time in which people were already acting within real direct, you know, society, basically in a society with true knowledge
mm-hmm.
before we had the fall into symbolic thought. But the concepts that you use to describe that, of course, are our concepts. You're in this society, right?
Right.
So you're stuck just as much as any other philosopher trying to describe a society that came before the one you're in that had a different...
I think you're quite right. That's you know, again, that's why I don't like the term philosopher. I mean, that's where you get. You only get that far. And so I'm only... I can speculate about that as well, but I try to bring it back to something specific, you know, what, you know,
to the scientific.
Well, yeah, facts. And there's a lot we won't know probably ever about how people lived, and certainly not about their consciousness. I mean, you know, I freely admit you could impute different things based on what evidence there is regarding equality and non-objectification of women and sharing and so forth and so on, which is just part of Orthodox anthropology, really. But you still, I mean, that doesn't really complete the picture. I mean, I'm not saying it does.
What I wonder about is in societies that were hunter-gatherer societies, say, whether they had an apprehension of the world directly or not. I mean, I want to kind of put aside the question about whether they were happier or whether they were more free. I don't doubt that they were in many ways. I just, because I have this, I don't know, quirk of wanting to use these concepts to try to understand, I want to examine whether it could be conceivable that they were not already in some kind of symbolic thought that, however, whatever it would be, it could be a different way of representing the world than what we are in now. Maybe less abstract. Maybe abstract.
It could be. It could be very different. And again, I don't know how one pieces that together. You know, Freud thought that we were telepathic, that there wasn't anything symbolic. He didn't think that was so fantastic, though. I mean, he was, you know, kind of, I guess, in general, impatient for the move to domestication to come along. But it's interesting. Somebody is hyper-rationalist in so many ways, anyway, as Sigmund Freud. Thought that was an early stage.
I mean, historically we were not that we were telepathic now, but that at some point in the past we had been telepathic.
Right, in the past, right, pre-symbolic. And I don't really know why he said that. I mean, he doesn't develop that, and I don't remember the text, but he does say that very clearly, that that's what he thinks.
Right. Well, just going back to Hegel for a moment, and I want to point out that Hegel didn't separate his philosophy from the society that he was in or from society. In fact, Hegel was perhaps the first philosopher to come along and point to the fact that philosophy and ideas are socially produced. And he kind of mapped out how that happened. And what the,
to some degree.
Yeah. I mean, that was his argument. I mean, and Marx was picking up on Hegel and taking it to the next step. But, you know, he starts with sense certainty and he ends up with the problem of perception, and then the next step for Hegel is the way that we try to solve it. And we try to solve it by finding another consciousness that will verify us, recognize us as the what he calls the universal consciousness, and that sets up this master-slave dialectic. But he then takes it, you know, down to the next step or up to the next step, and it becomes a social order. And I think he makes the argument that societies are basically set up as a struggle, that a struggle for recognition and a struggle for consciousness, to be the consciousness that gets to direct how we're going to produce the world and what we're going to be doing to reproduce the world. And he, I think, is aiming at saying, recognizing that fact, recognizing the inherency of struggle, will be a way to gain real mastery over ourselves, as opposed to being either stuck in sense certainty or just self-consciousness.
Well, yeah, but I mean, frankly, I don't really know what that means. I mean, you could look at Hegel and say all of the movement of spirit to the grand unity. I mean, various people have pointed out how totalitarian that is, you know, as a model, as a movement of society and everything else. I mean, for example, you know, I think it's worth pointing out or remembering that Hegel in Prussian saw this fragmented German state or many, many states, principalities, powerless in the face of Napoleon, for example, and wanted a unification, wanted a powerful state. And his philosophy, on one level, is nothing but that. You know, in other words, it doesn't exist in the abstract. Well, it does, but I mean, what did he really want? I mean, you can read that. You can read the history in all of these abstractions, which could scarcely be more abstract. I mean, you know, that's what it was about on one level. I mean, I'm not reducing it simply to that, but I think it's worth keeping in mind. That's what...
Right. I'm not saying that Hegel, you know, arrived at the absolute back in his day, or that he was able to really enact his philosophy. And I think that I think Marx came along after and tried to correct it or to advance it, the thought, and didn't succeed either. But I'm just pointing out.
Well, you could say he succeeded all too well in some ways. You know, that maybe we'll get into that Marxism.
Well, let me just say just straight up what I think is good, or what we can take away from this idea of recognizing the necessity for struggle, which is that if we recognize that life is a struggle and that society is based on inequality, we can be aware of that as we act in the world, and not take whatever our position is as being natural or preordained, but instead as a result of a struggle, which we, you know, have the obligation to move beyond, that we don't actually want to stay at the whatever level we've got worked out now. That I just think that recognizing your own implication in some sort of struggle gives you the ability to at least start to change the way the struggle is set up.
Uh-huh, that makes sense.
And that's something that I don't think that a primitivist position holds on to enough. I think a lot of times people want to act as though they can return to the land or return to a natural way of life without having already been implicated in the struggle that's going on, and without having to be conscious of the struggle.
I think you're quite right about that. That's an illusion to think you can just drop out and that's the answer. I mean, it's in a certain way, it's part of the answer, but I think that's it. It definitely, I think maybe part of the problem or part of the mistake lies in the realization that it wasn't always like that. In fact, for probably about 2 million years, it didn't require struggle. It wasn't a matter of struggle. I mean, that only comes much later. I mean, much, much, much later. You know, it's one of the fallacies that often we moderns make, the presentism fallacy, where we just assume it was always like this. And even though we know it wasn't always like this, now what is the relevance of knowing that? I mean, but it, you know, in saying that, I'm not approving of primitivism, meaning simply trying to find a cave and just go there or something. I mean, that we don't have the luxury of that. I don't think that's not. I would say, though, if I could just stick this in, I think it is important at the same time that people are trying to experiment and trying to reconnect with actual techniques and so forth. I mean, you know, what did indigenous people eat, you know, and so forth. I mean, a million different questions. If we were able to break through and redefine our relationships and so forth, and then we could... you know, because you get down to, if you want to get rid of civilization and you don't know how to live without it, then, you know, that's probably not going to happen. That's probably not going to be very inviting. So I think you can equip yourself, you can make yourself more autonomous and more likely to be part of the struggle if we can reskill, you know, and so forth. I mean, in terms of, in a general sense, you know, to try to think about our dependency right now, our almost total dependency, and the fact that we better do something about that dependency. I mean, that's not necessarily just going off and taking off your clothes and, you know, going out to the land. But there are people on the land that have that perspective of what are we going to do if and when all this collapses? You know, that's a real question. I think a lot of people on the left have no interest in that. But I think that's a real, there's a real area there of serious concern.
When I first began to study chimps, I thought that the task was to just map out more and more similarities, to find areas of cognition that hadn't been studied yet and simply show that chimps were just like us. Imagine teaching a small child to stand up a block upright. And you can teach a chimp to do the same thing. Oh, I'll set up the block here, set up a block here. I can see everything. It's very, very clear. And I get a piece of fruit for doing it. But what happens when you introduce a small subtlety into this situation where you trick them and just make the block off-center just enough that it keeps falling over? Well, the chimp will come in, set up the good block, set up the block that you've tricked them with, but then it falls over. Well, the chimp can see that it's not the way it's supposed to be, so they try again, and they try again, and they move it to one place, and they move it to another place, and they keep trying to get it to stand up because they know what is supposed to happen, but they have no understanding or no inclination to ask why. What unobservable part of the situation is causing that block to keep falling over? The young child will enter, set up the good block, try to set up the block that we've tricked them with. But when it falls over, well, first they'll try again, and maybe try again. But very quickly, they'll turn it over, feel the bottom of it, shake it, try to discern what unobservable property of that block is causing it to fall over. That's the fundamental core difference, I believe, between humans and chimps, that humans ask why. We're constantly probing for unobservable phenomenon to explain the observable. It's what's driven us to discover gravity. It's what's driven us to probe into the mysteries of quasars. And it's the same thing that drives us to probe into the mysteries of each other in our everyday lives. Why does she keep doing that? Why does he keep behaving like that? He must think this. He must believe this. I don't understand. Why?
Here's my thing. What we're going to have to do then is create some other economic, political system for us to live in that will, you know, the collapse can't happen without, you know, or sublation, to take a Hegelian term, can't happen unless something new is coming out of the process.
Yeah.
And I think that requires symbolic thought and creative thought, and that we aren't going to be able to return to what Marx would call species being, or what Hegel might call sense certainty. I think that we're going to be far less secure in our feelings of what's real and what isn't as we try to make something new.
Well, it's a huge challenge. I mean, I think what we need, to put it slightly differently, is a totally different paradigm, you know, a different way of thinking altogether. Not more of the left, you know, where it just scrapes along hoping for some reform and has no vision of something qualitatively different. That's why I think anarcho-primitivism, and that's a clunky word, I don't even know how we got saddled with it, but that does point towards something absolutely different that breaks from the whole civilizational dynamic. And without that, I think we're just kind of stuck, and we're not going to cook up something that makes sense, that isn't destroying the planet, that isn't producing these pathologies in society, like these shootings. That's one thing I talk about quite a bit, you know, these mass shootings. You know, we're not even looking at what kind of society, how bad it's gotten, and why. And that takes you, I think it implies anyway, looking at a whole different thing. And I think, to me, just to jump ahead here maybe a little bit, the left is in the way of that. The left is in the way of that. I mean, I was a trade union organizer. I'm totally from the left, but now I'm anti-left. It's blocking the way in some very serious, critical ways toward moving the discussion toward some kind of paradigm shift.
I don't completely disagree with your estimation about the left, with your critique of the left. That's one of the reasons why the podcast that you're going to be featured on is called Pop the Left, because we need to... We need to puncture it, deflate it, figure out, you know, let it make it take a look at what it can't do or at the problem that it's not willing to face. But I would just put this idea to you, which is that because, you know, you would agree that whenever you are trying to critique anything, you're always doing it from a subjective position, and that subjective position is something that comes together in a society. In other words, you're implicated in this one, in capitalism and civilization and all of it. And I just look to primitivism. I look at primitivism as the kind of supplement that's needed to continue civilization as we know it. That the very idea of primitivism is only something that can really be born in a civilized, symbolic society. That you didn't have that kind of idea.
Well, you didn't have any kind of ideas. I mean, you could put it that way, too. I mean, everything is a thinking choice. Well, actually, I think it isn't. I mean, if I could just clarify that, we make choices, but they're not always conscious choices, right? I mean, of course, Marx thought so, too. I mean, but if all these things are off the table, for example, technology, I mean, I think, for example, technology is now taking the place of ideology. It's the one that makes, it's really, and this is a reified way to put it, I realize, but what makes the promises and the claims? It's technology. It's not really, quote, political anymore, because that has failed. There's nobody that believes that stuff anymore. So, but if everybody, certainly everybody on the left, is consigned to the idea, resigned to the idea that technology is neutral, then you never politicize it. You never problematize it. And that's one of the concrete examples right there. If we're never doing that, then everything just proceeds basically the way it's always proceeded. I mean, that's one thing. And there we get right to the question of Marxism. Marxism is nothing if not industrialization. That was the cardinal thing for Karl Marx. How do we industrialize? How do we remove the fetters to the realization of the means of production, or how do we industrialize without any brakes on it at all? Well, I take the exact opposite point of view of that. How do we stop productionism? How do we stop the onslaught of technology that's just draining everything and just ruining everything? I mean, I know I'm throwing out a million things here, but that's, in other words, I think it's impossible to say you want to pop the left if you're still a Marxist.
Well, okay. I disagree. And you know, but I can see what you're driving at. With Marx, he was, the strange thing about Marx is if you want to find someone who admired capitalism, he was probably one of capitalism's greatest admirers. He saw it as a breakthrough, a good thing in the history of humanity, because it broke with feudalism and with the kind of ideas of natural or God-given authority that came before. It was the very fact that all that was left in a capitalist society was this abstraction called value to discipline production that was hopeful about.
Right, right. He saw capitalism revolutionizing everything. Yeah, he was thrilled by that. Well, but now, in 2013, I mean, we can see That was horrible. That was look at the disaster. Yeah, the revolutionized everything, including the biosphere we're supposed to live in. I mean, you know, it's ruinous. I mean, I don't know how. In other words, I've been in India, for example. I see the industrializers killing the indigenous people, poisoning everything. I mean, it's almost as bad as China. I mean, that's the world system. That's the world globalized capitalism, and that's the name of the game. And all the technology rests on industrialism, right? So you've got to, if you don't question that, if you don't want to reject that, which no Marxist does, otherwise he wouldn't be Marxist, in my view. Then what? I mean, you talk about the need for a qualitative change, for a break, for a new paradigm, but, well, where does it's got to sweep that away.
Okay, but what is it that kind of mode of production rests on? I mean, what is it that industrialism rests on?
It goes back to division of labor. It goes back to domestication. You know, it's pretty fundamental. It's not. It didn't happen overnight, obviously.
Right. It relies on the division of labor, but not just. It's not that the problem isn't that one person is good at being a doctor and someone else is good at, you know, I don't know, sewage treatment or something. That the problem is that there's a fundamental division of labor in the capitalist society that drives.
Well, or any society. You know, Marx early on. You probably know, he wanted to overcome division of labor. And later in his career, he said, well, that was wrong. There's nothing you can do about division of labor. I mean, there was a consistency at that point, because you can't be an industrializer and claim that you want to do away with division of labor. So there you go. I mean, in other words, he was honest about it. But so you never get rid of capitalism.
He wanted to get
rid of something else, but it's still capitalism.
He wanted to divide up. He wanted to get rid of the division of labor because.
Oh, he gave up on that.
Right.
He gave
originally,
up on
just originally, though.
Right.
He wanted to get rid of the division of labor originally because he saw the division of labor, and especially the division between physical labor and mental labor, as the foundation of unfreedom in the world, whether it's of the class struggle, which he wanted to end.
Well, and dividing the self, you divide the self, and then the class division comes right after that. I mean, if you go back, and that's what he wanted to do. That was the original, very radical perspective he had.
Right, and then later on, he wrote Das Kapital, and he started to develop his value theory, where he saw the production of abstract value through capitalist institutions.
Well, it's also true that there's nothing abstract about it. You're creating divided people, crippled people. That's why he was totally wrong about the proletariat being a revolutionary force. It was a domesticated force. It was only the artisans and others who hung on to the pre-industrial modes that were militant and radical. It was not factory people. Everybody, and you know, that's well known. I mean, there's no. But that it gets back to that. Well, if you don't do away with division of labor, then you've got these masses who are really not going to be very radical, and it looks like they're less radical. I mean, that if you don't challenge that again, you know, then you're just kind of we're stuck with the fundamental problem, and it keeps getting worse.
Okay, but just to finish out the thought about the difference between the early Marx and the later Marx in terms of the division of labor. Is that he saw in his later work a class system which was driving the economy, where it was a matter of exploiting the propertyless class, the laboring class, that gave the economy its engine. Value under capitalism doesn't come. You know, the whole labor theory of value is what he came up.
Well, right, and he didn't invent class struggle. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of years before it. It's way before industrial capitalism came along. You know, that's
right. But the difference between, say, class struggle between a feudal lord and a serf is that it's directly social, whereas in capitalism, it's taking place through this abstraction of value production and less visible because of that. So, so anyhow. I don't think that you can I see continuity between the desire to get rid of the division of labor, especially the division between mental work and physical work, and this later perspective where he wants to do is get rid of the labor value as the force guiding production, that he wants to come up with a means of production which would be production between equals, production where people have chosen something other than just abstract value that they want to produce.
Well, but they can choose whatever they want. It's still grunt labor on the part of millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people. I mean, come on, you can call it whatever you want, but that is what is crippling the lives, stunting the lives, draining off their time and their energy. It doesn't matter what, I mean, I don't see that as, I mean, that just seems like a kind of sophistry to me. And that's the problem for anarchists, many anarchists, as well as Marxists. In other words, you know, if I could just, maybe this might shed a little light on that as a, in terms of opposition. You know, the classic anarchist thing is smash the state and abolish capitalism, right? But the people who say that, let's just say the people who say that, who are not primitivist, say that takes care of everything. Maybe that's kind of what the way you're putting it. It's slightly differently, but you know, you don't need primitivism or something, because if you do that, then everything's fine. But the problem is, they want to preserve all this. They want to preserve the factories and everything else. They want to have industrial life. They want to have mass society. And if you want to, in other words, the only way to get rid of capitalism and the state, when you think about it, is to get rid of things as they are. In other words, you got to have a primitivist solution, or you cannot do away with capitalism or the state. For example, you know, it's just a practical question. If you got rid of the state, let's just say the anarchists could wave a wand and there's no more state. Well, the whole incredibly complex industrial technological system would go off the rails within hours. You've got to have all kinds of level of government and regulation and coordination by public bodies. You simply have to. If you don't have that, and the other thing is true too. You could say, okay, let's get rid of capitalism, but of course we need to keep all the technology. Well, then what does that mean? Does that mean you don't pay people? You want to get rid of wages? You know, how would you run it? There's absolutely no way to run it. So what I'm saying is, you are stuck with the state and capitalism unless you want to get rid of the material reality of it, which is a massified, industrialized, high-tech world.
Yeah, okay.
And I've never gotten an answer to that. I've never heard anyone point out the fallacy of that.
Okay, so let me just see if I can rearticulate your question, and then see if I can
you answer that? I mean,
well,
do you think
let me see if I can rearticulate it first, so
okay.
I'm sure I understand it, and then if I can, then I might try to answer it. So the problem is that getting rid of the state. I mean, first of all, I'm not someone who thinks that we can just get rid of the state and that will solve all our problems. But the anarchist position is, if you just all we need to do is get rid of the state, and then
and capitalism.
Well,
I think there's no anarchist who doesn't think you've got to get rid of capitalism.
Right. I think that my feeling is, and having been an anarchist for a long time, is that anarchists don't have a very good grasp of what capitalism is. So it's just another kind of authority. But I think dealing with the economic realm is different than dealing with the political realm, and you have to conceive of it differently. So, but your question is maybe the same question I have. Which is, how do we get rid of the state and the economy which it serves, the division between the property class and the laboring class, and the exploitation of people as the engine that drives our society? How do we get rid of that and the state apparatus which basically works to maintain that system?
Right, well put.
So, and what if we did get rid of that? What would we put in its place? Could we even conceive of having mass production of commodities for exchange the way that we do now? And then so
Well, if we can't, then you've already decided we can't get rid of capitalism.
Well, here's the thing. I put it into two things together. On the one side, I said, can we still have mass production? And then the other side, I said, of commodities made for exchange. Now, mass production, all that means is you get a lot of people working together on one thing. Production of commodities for exchange, actually, that's the thing that they're working on. So what I'm saying is that we might be able to have mass production, massive cooperation on projects that's based on something other than the construction of commodities for exchange.
But you'd still have division of labor.
Well,
if you have people stuck in the factories or the mines or the foundries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're certainly not getting rid of division of labor.
I'm not saying how we're bringing people together to do this mass project. And I'm not, and I also agree that we probably wouldn't get rid of all division of labor, but I think that we would have something other than the kind of division of labor that we have now if we could conceive of something to produce other than commodities for exchange.
Okay, well, as a Marxist, you see that distinction as really important. I see it as kind of not very important.
Well, right.
You've still got the basic stuff, and you can say it's for this or that, but it's still the same. It's the same stuff. Isn't it or not?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I think that when you make look, you're not someone who wants to get rid of all production. You still
I certainly am. I certainly am. That's the whole point.
Do you still think
mass
that people
production is the problem? Mass production gives you mass society.
Well, not,
and look
no.
how awful and unhealthy it is.
We can get rid of mass. I agree. You want to get rid of mass production, but you don't want to get rid of all production. Hunting,
well,
gathering,
depends on
is
how we define it.
Well, just when you get something out of the, you go to nature, you go to the world, and you gather something up and you use it for yourself.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, if you want to define it that broadly, sure.
That's a kind of production. And then if you have a group of people doing that together to live together, then you have some sort of societal production at that point, whether it's producing,
uh-huh.
you know, huts or skyscrapers. That's both of those are kind of production, a social production.
Okay. It's
yeah.
kind of a big difference. So if
they're
you
very huge
skyscrapers,
but the
what's
difference,
involved in making a skyscraper? You know that you, then we can break it down.
It's a lot more production in the skyscraper than the hut, and but also
sure.
the question is, to what end? What's the purpose? What are they aiming at in producing a hut as opposed to a skyscraper? And one thing that would be different is with the hut, they're not actually trying to produce something more. They're providing what they need, subsistence production, right? It's just for themselves right then. Whereas this kind of production we're in now, we're always trying to produce for its own sake. We're always making stuff that we're not even going to use. In fact, most of the time, what drives our economy is making stuff that we're going to sell, not that we're going to use.
Uh-huh.
And that's what's important to Marx, is that we have all this production going on that isn't going directly for our use. It's actually being produced for its own sake.
I want to start with two quotes from Marx that Lukács mentions. And the first is from the German ideology. Marx said that the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, i.e. the class which is the ruling the class which is the ruling material force in society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. That's quote one. Quote two, also from Marx, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. Now, if you think about it, those two quotes at least partially contradict each other. Because, you know, obviously if the ruling class dominate in terms of ideas, then how can the working class emancipate itself? And in a way, I think what George Lukács does, if you can summarise what is a kind of quite immense and sometimes a bit intimidating body of work, what he does is to explain that paradox, that contradiction, better than any other socialist, Marxist has done at any time. Because the fact that everything is reduced to a commodity under capitalism. A commodity is just a unit of product that is produced in order to create a profit for the capitalist. the fact that everything is bought and sold hides the fundamental relations of capitalist society. It kind of tends to hide the fact that, that capitalism is a class society and that it's based on exploitation. The commodification of society includes human beings. Human beings are commodified in the sense that certainly our labour power is commodified. When we go to work, we sell our labour power to the boss. And that process of selling our labour power to the boss appears on the surface to be, you know, fair exchange. You get a job, there's a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and that's okay. And that relationship kind of hides the fact that what is really going on is robbery. And so commodity production has the effect of covering up the real relations of society and giving the relations between people the appearance of being relations between things. And so everything is what George Lukacs called reified, turned into things. Everything is actually turned into a thing and taken out of the real process and the real relations of society. So, as I say, this experience isn't just limited to the kind of marketplace. It isn't just limited to buying and selling on the high street or online or whatever. It reaches into the workplace, and when you go to work, you experience work as you're kind of a component of the production process. As he says, a worker is a mechanical part incorporated into a mechanical system. He finds it pre-existing and self-sufficient. It functions independently of him, and he has to conform to its laws, whether he likes it or not. And so when you go to work, this kind of process appears to be completely, you know, it appears to be kind of natural, God-given. It happened before you were born, it carries on after you die, and there's nothing you can do about it. Just one last quote, actually. Just to give an idea of the kind of impact that this has on us. What Lukács says is that these kind of processes dominate our state of mind to such an extent that the personality can do no more than look on helplessly while its own existence is reduced to an isolated particle in an alien system. I don't know if that rings any bells, but I mean, that is a kind of summation of what he felt was the experience of living under capitalism and how it disempowers you and makes you feel atomised and separate and out of any kind of real historical process, which is in reality going on kind of behind the scenes, behind your back. There is, however, luckily for the capitalists, a big catch. And that catch is that although as human beings we are in a sense turned into commodities, or at least our labour power when we sell it on the market is turned into a commodity, labour power is a very special commodity. It's a unique commodity because it is actually attached to a brain in a way that no other commodity is. And because it's attached to a brain, it can become self-conscious and it can become aware of the way that it is being treated. And this for Lukács was the kind of secret to where resistance can come from.
You know, maybe we should stop for a second and consider who's the we. In other words, what is society? I mean, if we're thinking about the hut, we might say band society is 80 people or something. In other words, you know, we might be assuming, are we talking about the modern nation, or are we talking about when your world, in effect, is in terms of what you're responsible for and accountable for, is this what I would think is the goal of is a very radically decentralized situation. So, you know, in other words, we have to be, maybe we need to kind of define who's the we.
Well, yeah.
That's making the decisions.
But I think what defines who the we is what is the aim of the social production. In other words, when you are living in a tribe, you have a different conception of who you are as a person.
Well, exactly, sure.
When you're living in a,
define
in a capitalist.
What kind of life you want, what kind of society you want, what, you know, all the rest of it, all those
right,
things.
Right, but my point about we today in a capitalist society produces spending 5 times more in production than we do on consumption is that we make things for the sake of making them. We produce things for the sake actually of making them for exchange, for selling them and making abstract profit, not real profit. the world could go to hell, and but there'd still be people with tons of money in their bank account, right? So, and that's then that abstraction.
Well, if that presupposes banking systems, and you know what I mean. What I'm trying to say, Doug, is you're not getting away from the basic stuff. You want to make it better.
I'm not describing the better world now. I'm describing the world we're in. I'm not saying this is better. I'm just describing the world we're in. I'm saying, I'm saying today our problem is that we create five times more. We spend our
problem. It's not my problem. None of that makes sense to me. I mean,
it's a problem if you want to change it.
Well, let me put it this way, man. It's a problem if you want to keep defining things in terms of the system. And I would argue that that's what you're doing. You see these irrational, you know, goofy parts of how capitalism works. But changing the goofy parts, you could improve. And I'm not saying this is your aim. Of course, it isn't. But you know, if you took out all the irrationalities and had production for use, you'd still have capitalism, obviously, right? I mean, there's no qualitative difference. You just make it a less insane system. You still have mass production and people stuck in the factories and all the rest of it.
I think producing directly for use isn't something capitalism can do, because as soon as you do that, you are no longer producing in order to create value. You don't need a class system to do that. Although, frankly, I'm not a primitivist, and I don't really know what it would mean to produce directly for human use, because I think human use, what we need, is always is both conceptual and physical, that we have.
Well, you know, we started with this question of direct perception,
right?
Or, you know, that's what you were.
That's what I want.
Kind of beginning with. Well, so, you know, we can focus on that. What is direct? Do you want a direct life? You know, we're losing direct experience on getting back to that personal level of the individual.
Yeah.
You know, so direct means to me direct, not it's nothing abstruse. It's face to face. I mean, and I could just put the whole thing that way. As a matter of fact,
yeah, right.
You know, do you want a direct face to face life? Or do you want mass society where there's virtually no face-to-face that has any consequences?
I'm not sure if that's how I would frame it. But as a worker, I have lots of face-to-face relationships every day. And
Yeah, but they're not the ones that decide the values of society. Of course we do. We wouldn't be human if we didn't have our friends and our love relationships and so on. But that's not, you know, if you're living in a small, relatively small group, you are face-to-face accountable. You know, that's the whole ethos. You know, that's getting back to the anthropology. And I'm not saying it has to be exactly like that, but
I have my friends and family who I have face-to-face relationships with in my leisure time, but most of my time where I'm really dealing with another human being face-to-face physically, I'm dealing with them in an office, I don't cherish those relationships. I don't – the fact that they're face-to-face doesn't improve them at all.
Well, that's my point. That's my point. In this kind of setup, of course not, because they're not making the decisions any more than you are. I mean, you know, that's the problem. And when anarchists say, we need to get rid of all the cops, of course I want to get rid of the cops, but what kind of a world would it be where you wouldn't condemn somebody for calling the cops? I mean, what choice do a lot of people have? You know, and we can't just deal with abstractions. You got to think about what, you know, as you were saying before, what would be the practical scene there? You know, when is it that people could take responsibility? That's what primitivism means. In fact, that's what anarchism means. Not a massified deal where every day it gets worse in terms of having control of anything, having autonomy, having a relationship that counts. You know, of course we have, I'm not saying, you know, again, that we don't have relationships that count, but they don't count in terms of how society exists.
Right. They don't count, because the thing that defines what counts in our society is this alienating economy, and you know so you're the what determines what you do on a daily basis isn't your personal relationships anymore.
Exactly right. But it used to be that way, I think. It used to be something like that.
Right. But I would say that in the societies where it was more face-to-face, there were still mediating ideas between people. And that often those were religious ideas. I mean, maybe not all the way back to hunters and gatherers. I don't know, right? I mean, that's terra incognita. I have no idea.
That comes later, you know, the religious consolations and so on and so on. Anyway, yeah,
But you can look to people who live as hunter and gatherers today, and you find very rigid belief systems that sustain their society.
Well, there are almost none today virtually none that haven't been contacted. In other words, they're already, we could say, contaminated or whatever. I mean, there's no pure hunter-gatherer thing.
Yeah, by definition, if we know about them, they've been contaminated because we know about them, right? I mean, if we...
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, to put it in a kind of crude way,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, the Aboriginals in Australia, I know a little tiny bit about, not very much, but I do know that they have, you know, sets of spiritual beliefs which are far different from anything in the West or even in the East, but that have remained the same and which set up hierarchies of certain kinds and dictate to them what matters and what they should do.
Right. Oh, yeah. And I wouldn't say that even in the so-called perfect nomadic hunter-gatherer that everything was absolutely Edenic. You know, that would be silly to say that everything was perfect. But there really were a lot of things that functioned quite well without destroying the environment and so on and so
right.
on.
Right. Mean, yeah. Oh,
again like we won't even know about. We can't. You could imagine things, but you know that's. You know, then you're dealing with ideology. You're putting in the picture that you want to see. You know, but I think. And the point there, it was interesting to me to, I remember a conversation a few years ago where people were saying, well, what if we discovered that actually it was kind of dreadful? We've been getting this rosier picture of hunter-gatherer life as all sharing and all that, which is the orthodox picture right now, actually. But what if it was really kind of nasty? And the earlier thinking that everybody was killing each other was true. I don't think that's going to happen because there's too much evidence the other way. But what if it was? Well, the answer was that some anarchists I heard say it wouldn't change our goal to have a face-to-face world, you know, to have to break it down. So we're not running the state. We're not running a world system. We're not doing any of that. You know, that would be the goal, even if it's never happened before. I think it, you know, roughly has happened before and persevered for so many, many thousands of generations. But in other words, it's a goal. It couldn't be realized overnight. You know, nobody I know is thinking that, you know, that we can just, have some wonderful rosy ideas and then boom, it's all going to be nirvana. Well, no, it's not going to work that way. We could probably agree on that.
Yeah, I agree on that.
Gentlemen, the sum of our knowledge is pitiful. It has been my singular good fortune to get hold of a new instrument that brings a small patch of the universe a little bit closer. It's at your disposal. Make use of it.
Your Highness, ladies and gentlemen, where is all this leading?
Are we as scholars concerned with where the truth might lead us?
Mr. Galilei, the truth might lead us anywhere.
What I want to figure out, really, and the reason I started with, you know, abstract stuff like Hegel and all that, is just what is the role of thought, of ideas, in a primitivist conception of the world? In other words, where would experience even be in that kind of world? Because it seems to me that primitivism is founded upon a reification, this confusion between the concrete and the abstract, the taking of what's abstract to be concrete. And I know that you are opposed to reification.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I think it's kind of murky. Maybe it's more a question of relative stuff. You know, maybe there is no pure bedrock intimacy with the world that I tend to suspect there was or something like that and which, by the way, postmodernism is defined against, which to me tells you something right there. You know, the banishing of presence, banishing of anything outside the symbolic, you know, that's really the whole game. And that's why they're so wedded.
Well, the postmodernists actually end up banishing symbolic thought as well, because it is always the Derridean. My understanding of the Derridean critique of structuralism, which is exactly what you just said. You know, everything's reduced to abstractions. Is Derrida says, but you can't find those without a substance. And so even the structures...
Well, let's put it another way. There's nothing outside culture. There's nothing but the text, as Derrida famously said. You know, in other words, you'll never get outside of symbolic culture. I mean, that's a founding point of view for deconstruction and for the rest of it. But anyway, you know, we could go off on that. But, you know, I think it's an open question, and I should have been doing better my writings earlier on to point out that it's speculation. It's not holy writ, you know, in terms of number. Where does the concept of number come? I mean, I think you can do a kind of anthropology of it and imagine easily that number didn't exist and didn't need to exist because you didn't have complex society. You didn't need a lot of these things. I mean, and now we're finding out linguistically, like the work of Daniel Everett and others, there are languages that don't have recursion, that don't have all these tenses. And that's probably just simply because their life didn't need that. They're not projecting into the future. They're not, you know, producing for some future sales or any of that stuff. So why wouldn't their conceptual apparatus reflect that? You know, it's just that simple. Although I would again concede that we don't actually know. You know, that's just, but it stands to reason to me that if you're looking at a society without all these things that require number and time dimensions and all the rest of it, well, why would they exist?
You see, and here's my thought. You might be right about that, but here's my thought. Just going back to the idea of reification is that without recursion, without recognizing recursion, you end up reifying concepts more. That you wrote in your book of Running on Empty, and I think it was the essay with that title, that a definition of Neanderthal spirituality, and I'll quote it to you, where the modern god might inhabit the land, the buffalo or the blade of grass, the Neanderthal spirit was the animal or the grass blade, the thing in its soul perceived as one single vital force, with no need to distinguish them with separate names. But what that means is that the name, the thing, the idea, is taken to be exactly identical with the particular instance of it. And that doesn't leave room for changing your conception.
Yeah, I see. Well, that was a poetic usage, and I forget who I was quoting there.
Yeah, you were quoting someone else. Perhaps,
I probably implied that, you know, that would be very nice, you know, but I don't know if I said that I could see it as in precisely that way, because that is a kind of, then whereas there's, you know, as you said before, this is where we're at now. I mean, you can have a critique of art and so forth. I mean, that's one of my most unpopular essays, The Case Against Art, which wasn't really the case against art. It was a speculation on why art develops. You know, I enjoy art and music and writing. I'm a writer and all the rest. But so we are here using our reified consciousness to try to get out of it. And that's a question in itself, like Adorno, I think, raised. Can you use reified means to get rid of reification? Well, if we can't, we're kind of fucked, you know, right? I mean, but it doesn't take away the problem. I mean, I think you're quite right in posing it that way. I mean, what exactly are we meaning there? We might want to go there, but how we get there, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's worth the cause, though, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that... Listen, here's the reason I was so frightened of talking to you, to be honest, really honest, was because I think your philosophy or your ideas are really pointing at the central issue for people who want to change the world today. I think you are making some fundamental mistakes, but I think that they're necessary mistakes. Oh. I think without you making those mistakes, we'll never get to where we need to be.
Hmm.
But this is, I think, the difference between you and me. I think that having ideas that aren't exactly right, that aren't matched up to reality, is the only way we can actually know anything or make any progress. If we take our ideas to be exactly right and to be matched up with reality, then we'll never re-examine them, and things will stay exactly as they are.
I totally agree. And a number of things that I've pushed out there may be false. You know, they may not be valid. They may not stand a test or a closer examination. You know, but thanks for that. I mean, because I think that's the highest goal, to fail and then learn something from it. You know, to try to push the discussion. We don't have much discussion in this society. It's ruled out. You can't bring up certain things, technology for one. And anyway, but yeah, I appreciate that, Doug. I'm not claiming to have all the answers, but damn, I'm far from that.
I think that your presupposition is that there is a way to have all the answers. Not that that you have them, but that's the aim. And I think the one answer I can – this is paradoxical, and I know I'm kind of violating my own idea here when I say this. I think the one thing we can be sure of is that we won't actually ever be perfectly matched up with the reality, that our conceptions are going to stay split off from and alienated from the world as it is.
Well, that sounds like a healthy attitude. That could well be so, yeah. And you can't claim these powers or these heights. I mean, yeah, but I think it's worth trying to go in that direction and seeing what stands in the way of movement in a disalienated direction. I mean, maybe all these people, including Hegel, you know, there are limits. There's always going to be alienation. But I mean, I don't like, constitutionally, I don't like accepting that. So if we push it, then we'll find out. I mean,
right. I think the one thing that you can do that is not alienated is say that alienation, which is necessary, is something I can actually understand directly and do something with. I can understand that if I'm going to create a different world, I'm going to have to move the way that we define the world, the way we get it wrong.
Mm.
That you see, not that. So now I'm going to say, okay, we're not going to divide up the world based on the propertyless and those with property. We're going to divide up the world, but just not that way. We're going to figure out as best we can, as in an egalitarian way as we can, how we're going to divide up the world and what we can live with. And then if we get it wrong, we'll know that it's our mistake, that's not the world doing it.
Yeah,
that it's
right,
us
right.
doing it.
Take responsibility and see what needs to be done and how far we need to go. I mean, I think we need to open it up to wild ideas, you know, wild, because look at the stark reality we're in. It's almost unbelievable. And yet we're supposed to be stuck with it. So, you know, the whole discourse in society is so incredibly limited. It's just, that's the first scandal or one of them, you know what I mean? You can't even have a public conversation.